Good afternoon. Welcome to the Should Nuclear Energy Be Part of the Solution to Climate Change debate. Most of you will have the bios on our speakers, so I'll just do a quick introduction. Here is Mark Deary from the Louth Greens, or Louth. He has been a campaigner against nuclear power in Ireland for near on 20 years. He is seated next to Dennis and Jim Morris, both from Better Environment Through Nuclear Energy, who foresee a future that includes nuclear energy as part of the solution to climate change. And at the end there, we have James Orr from Friends of the Earth. Before I begin, I'd just like to say that I'm very pleased that we're having this debate. Sometimes nuclear energy is seen as the no-go area for environmentalists, but I think our ability to debate this gives a tremendous amount of gravity to whatever position we finally take on this. And it's always nice to get alternatives to maybe the green policy or the green norm. Okay, so Mark, if you would like to begin.
Sure, thank you very much.
Sorry, we'll be having presentations from each of the speakers here, and then at the end we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for the invitation to address you at your annual conference. And it was great to walk into the room and get a sense of work and focus and determination among you all. So it's really encouraging to get that feeling from you. We had our AGM the other night in Louth, and it's very much a case of trying to imagine a new future for ourselves politically. So to come and see an organisation moving on is a very good thing. I have been involved in the anti-nuclear movement, if you like, for my adult life, I suppose. I was a plaintiff in a court action that began back in 1994 and finally finished a couple of years ago, where we tried to injunct British Nuclear Fuels from building and then operating the thermal oxide reprocessing facility at Sellafield. A process that we saw primarily as about the production of plutonium in an industry whose byproduct is electricity, but whose core function, and this is indisputable in the early days certainly, was militaristic. The industry itself, of course, has found many, many civil uses for nuclear fission, and the production of energy is one of them. In the Republic, the 1999 Electricity Supply Act expressly prohibits the Irish Minister for Energy from authorising the production of electricity, through the use of fissile material. And that is a bulwark, if you like, in Irish legislation that prevents Ireland from considering going nuclear without, obviously, removing that section of the Act. So that's the background against which I think about these things, that in the Republic it's outlawed by statute, if you like. The question of whether or not nuclear power has a role to play in addressing climate change is the point where I think pro-nuclear people and Green Party people sort of share the pitch. The match is on. I saw earlier that Chelsea were beaten 5-3 by Arsenal, and I dare say we'd score a few goals against each other today. But whether or not we find a winner is a moot point. Eamon Ryan, in his contribution there, mentioned policy driving economic decision making in so many ways, and he specifically referred to the commitment the ESB has given to taking 42% of all electricity onto the grid by being renewable by 2020, a feat that I've heard many say was technically not possible, but which now is going to be achieved, primarily because of policy decisions of the last government. The ESB stepped up to the plate and said that this could be done. So there are technical challenges, of course, in bringing renewables to onto the grid and into people's homes and into industry and so on, but many of them can be overcome. The most significant recent example of where policy led to almost what you could describe as a cataclysmic change within industry is in Germany, where Siemens recently announced that they were getting out of building nuclear power stations. They would be responsible for the development of all 17 of Germany's nuclear power stations. And up until a couple of years ago, Siemens would have said that nuclear power was a critical part of its mix in addressing climate change and a sustainable energy future. But it's changed, and changed dramatically, and an absolute turnaround on the part of Siemens, in that they've said that they are now pulling out of the nuclear sector and focusing their investment on renewables. Investment that already is worth 27 billion euro a year in Siemens alone. It accounts for 35% of all their revenues and is a profitable part of the business. And that is only going to increase. And I think it highlights, too, the fact that, and that Tom Burke is very, very good in this, an analyst on the economics of the nuclear industry. I've heard him speak about just the gradual decline in investment in nuclear power throughout the noughties, and that is only likely to continue now post-Fukushima. The much spoken of nuclear renaissance is more likely to become a nuclear sunset. And I don't say that with a sense of glee, maybe some relief, but not with glee. I just think it's a recognition of the fact that there are such serious limits on what nuclear power can achieve, on the management of the waste that it produces, which in fact, as again, to refer back to Ian Ryan, is an externalising of cost onto future generations. We don't know what to do with it, so we'll let the future deal with it. And in the case of the new build stations going being proposed for the west coast of the UK, the first thing they're going to do with it is leave it on site for 160 years until it's moved for final reprocessing or final storage or whatever the best use for it is in 160 years' time. I was in Wylfa last weekend in Wales, meeting with the concerned people of Anglesey, who are opposed to the development of Wylfa B. Many people are. In fact, one of the man who gave me the lift back to Holyhead said he didn't speak about this at his work. He works as a printer near Menai Bridge. And he wouldn't raise the issue of being against Wylfa B in his workplace because people are so desperate for jobs. And the promise from the Horizon Group, which is a conglomerate of E.ON and RWE, who are going to build this power station, is that there will be 5,000 jobs provided by the power station. That of course, is an argument that is easy to foist on rural communities, and one that my driver clearly feels the pressure of, so much so that he didn't speak openly about his opposition to Wylfa B. But it isn't the core issue, and a counter argument could be put that the sustainable and renewable energy sector will produce just as many jobs, but in a much more localised way. The 5,000 jobs that RWE E.ON may produce will probably, for the most part, be jobs that will end up back in the States or in France and will be brought in for a period. Will they be real local jobs? That's highly unlikely. On the contrary, in Green Ore, just south of the border, you'll be aware of a company called Open Hydro, who are now building seabed turbines and employing 100 people in very high-value jobs and with skill sets that really will define the future of work in this country. So I think although the jobs may be more dispersed and although the jobs may be less easy to quantify and create a big political hit off, they will be there. They will be in the sector. They will be in the energy sector. And it is obviously an easy one for the nuclear sector industry to say that 5,000 jobs in a single plant is very attractive. But it's not as simple as that. And I would counter that similar number of jobs or whatever, you know, I can't get into a numbers game on this, will be generated by the renewable sector. The fact that nuclear power doesn't create, in and of itself, doesn't create carbon dioxide and therefore doesn't lead to global warming in that act, in that core act, if you like, is, I suppose, the big case that's been made for nuclear power. The simple point I would leave you with is, do we want to, we can do that with renewables as well. It can be and is being done. And a company of the scale of Siemens has already made their mind up and said that it can be done. And are looking to producing over 30% of Germany's total energy needs, not just electricity needs, from renewables by within the next 20 years. So these things are achievable in two ways, if you accept the nuclear argument. And for the moment, I will. I will accept it, that core activity of nuclear fission doesn't create CO2, although much around it does. So do we choose a route that creates local sustainable jobs? Do we choose a route that doesn't create local waste for 160 years and centralised waste for eons to come? Do we want to turn turbines to make electricity in a very dangerous, although well-controlled and well-managed, I accept, process? Or do we want to do it using what is out there anyway in huge capacity? So much capacity, in fact, that Ireland could be exporting 2 out of every 3 gigawatt hours that it produces if we were to fully realise our renewables potential. And I can expand on that later in the Q&A if people want to hear a bit more about how we can do that. But roughly, Ireland requires 190,000 gigawatt hours a year of energy, not electricity, of energy, and we have the potential to do 675,000 gigawatt hours per year. So the capacity on this relatively underpopulated, windy, wet island is fantastic. Of course, we need to be properly grid connected to Britain and Europe, but if that can be done, I see it as an infinitely, infinitely preferable option to tackling climate change than going the nuclear route. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mark, for that. I think you've outlined the case against nuclear power very well. There have been a number of very salient comments over the last while from the talk from Eamon Ryan and from Mark about this whole issue, what we're talking about now, which is about climate change. And climate change is a global issue. And Eamon said that, and in thinking about it over the last few days, the Green Party, to me, is one of the few parties, it's probably the only party I know, that has a global impact. None of the others I can vote for can influence that much policies in Europe and in America. So I think it's important to look at this from a global perspective and recognise that the Green Party is well placed to influence this. The Green Party policy, as far as I can see, was developed about 4 years ago or so. So, and I want to congratulate the members here in Northern Ireland for inviting us up to consider nuclear power again. It's not a terribly popular topic at the moment, as you might imagine, post Fukushima. But it is important that, seeing as you have a very strong policy on it, to check every now and again, are we still right? And I congratulate you on that. I hope I give you some information here that would possibly make you have another look at it. And I don't think it's a match. I don't think it's a match, Mark, between ourselves and yourselves, the anti-nuclear, because it's not in a match one team wins, the other team loses. But what's at stake here is the future of, not the planet. The planet will survive. The people on the planet. How well will the people survive? So it's a little bit bigger than a match between the pair of us. I can say that Benny is the name of the group, Better Environment with Nuclear Energy. We're a totally voluntary group. We're not aligned to any political party or any company and don't get sponsorship from any company or anything like that. We all do this on our own voluntary time. Half the members are retired. We have experience in nuclear regulation, in nuclear physics, in nuclear energy, in regular energy, wind energy, renewable energy, marine engineers, mechanical engineers, economics. We have a wide range. And it's all spread out amongst the 10 of us. We have a number of advisors as well in areas that we haven't got the expertise in. So let's get started. And as I say, we're going to take it from a global perspective. And we started with some basic facts. Now, in talking to Conor before the meeting, I asked what the audience was going to be like, and he assured me, and I wasn't surprised to find, that you would have good experience in the energy area, and we could talk at a reasonably high level about this, because I'm going to go fairly fast through it. But let's start with some basic facts. The world energy at the moment is 16 terawatts. Now, that's 16 million megawatts on average. And if you divide that by the 7 billion population that's here on the planet at the moment, that works out at about 2,400 watts per person at all times, all day, all night, per man, woman and child on the planet. That is, if you remember the old 100-watt bulbs we had that gave out lots of light and lots of heat, that's 24 of them are on, the equivalent of that, on for us at all times, 365 days of the year. The global energy use is expected to grow by 50% by 2030. And I have a couple of slides on that to talk you through that. And I think it's necessary in allowing the developing countries to lift billions out of the poverty gap. 80% of the energy that we use at the moment is produced by fossil fuels. And that's the measure of the challenge. We have to get up to replacing those fossil fuels by whatever means possible. I don't want to concentrate on this slide, but it just shows the disparity of energy use. If you see the bit down the bottom here, where the USA, and it's not the greatest user per capita, but it uses the equivalent of 10.5 kilowatts. That's 105 bulbs on that they have, right? On the more populous countries, China, India, and Bangladesh, that represents about a third of the population of the globe, and they can use down as far as 210. Now, the average, as I said, is 2,400. So even if we kind of, if the USA and the UK, Ireland is slightly more than that, Britain is slightly less, but overall it's 5.2. And if we introduce energy efficiencies, which we fully believe in, reduction in energy use, we fully believe in, and go fully renewables, we're still going to find that the amount of energy that we need won't come down sufficiently, because there aren't sufficient of us on the planet to overcome the amount of increase of energy use that the poorer countries are going to experience. So let's go ahead and have a little look at it. The International Energy Agency, they were trying to figure out, and before I go into that slide, let's go back a little bit, that they said, well, how is the energy use going to develop over the next 20 years? And they didn't take the business as usual case. They took the case of all the policies that every government has agreed, for instance, the 2020 European plan or the Irish plan for 40% of our electricity from renewables by 2020, and said, if we did that, how much would our energy use increase and how much would our CO2 footprints increase by 2030? And that's the red curve there. Now, that is the one based on all the policies. If we implement all the policies, we'd find there'll be about a 55% increase in the CO2. Now, there is another policy that you'd be more aware of than I am, more familiar with, I mean, and that is the 450 policy scenario. If we manage to implement that internationally, we'll still find that the energy use will go up by about 40% and the CO2 will increase by about 30% globally. Now, this is the best scenario that we have. And I think this is the topic of the talk today is about climate change, and we're assuming that man-made CO2 is a huge contributor to that. I think it's safe to assume that rather than otherwise. To show you, and this is a complex slide, you won't be able to see it from there because I thought we'd have a bit more space here, but what happens, this is the 2030 scenario, and this is if we implement all the policies that are agreed at the moment. The bottom one there is coal, that's oil, that's gas, that's nuclear, hydro, and up there is renewables, which includes geothermal, solar, wind, biomass. So under the current policies, if we manage to implement everything that we've agreed to, we're still going to reach 80% of our energy use is going to be from fossil fuels, right? And if we go for the 450 policy scenario, which I hope we can, we're still going to find that around about 60% of our energy is from fossil fuels. And they are just the facts of the matter. It's important for the people in developing countries, because this now is a picture here of the Human Development Index based on your life expectancy at birth, your education, and the gross national product it is now. It used to be gross national index. And it shows here that this is the index, and the OECD countries are in red here. And we are all straddling around the 0.9 of Human Development Index. The ones in blue are the non-OECD. Some of them use a lot of energy. Here's the energy demand here in tons of oil per capita. Some of them use quite an amount of energy, but most of them use very small amounts of energy, as we saw again from the Bangladesh situation and the India situation earlier. If they're going to come up to a Human Development Index, and I think Eamon said it's important that we did that, go up to about 0.9, it's going to take about the equivalent of 3 tonnes of oil per capita. Now, at the moment where we are is at about an average of 1.7. So there I've just drawn that in. And again to say that even with the current population, if the poor people were to reach the development index of 0.9, the poorer nations, we would find our energy use doubling. Now, if we manage to draw back our energy use, the energy use will increase by 1.8 times instead of doubling. Now, it gets worse, because that's just looking at the population of 7 billion. Everyone predicts that the population is going to increase quite considerably more than that, 8 billion by 2030, 10 billion by 2100. Who knows where it's going to go? But that's going to make the problem even worse. Due to the shortage of time, I'm not going to go into this slide much. It just shows the amount of people worldwide who have no access to electricity at the moment, in cities and if anyone's interested, afterwards we can have a look at this. This slide here shows a number of sources of causes of death worldwide, and we can see here that smoke from biomass contributes 1.3 million deaths per annum. So this is what we're trying to put into perspective about the global situation rather than the individual situation. The people are certainly dying of a certain cause, and other people are looking and saying, well, what is the impact on my backyard? Am I going to be relatively safe or not? The energy comes, as I said, 80% from fossil fuels, of which the breakdown is 44% from oil, about a third from coal, and about a quarter from natural gas. The combustible renewables, which is mainly in the underdeveloped countries, would be 10%. They rely on it for cooking and for heat. Nuclear energy only provides 5%. So it's not going to be a bullet. There's no way that nuclear energy is going to expand by 20-fold. It's not the ultimate solution. It could be part of the solution. Hydro contributes 5%. It's pretty much maxed out. If the amount of hydro energy doubled, that'll be about as much as we could do. The rest of it, including the geothermal, solar, wind, and all that, contributes a half of 1%. So if we're trying to replace the 80% of fossil fuels, we have a long way to go. So we want to make sure that we are on the right track. I'm just going to point to the saying at the end here, in Saudi Arabia, saying, "My father rode a camel, I drive a car. My son flies a plane, his son will ride a camel." Is that true? It possibly is. We could spend again another week looking at whether we've reached peak oil, peak gas, and when peak coal is going to come about. And there are people who spend lifetimes looking at it. Without going into the environmental disasters that face us from the point of view of trying to extract oil from tar sands and gas from fracking and that kind of stuff. But suffice to say that the fossil fuels took 300 million years to develop, and we're going to spend them in the blink of an eye. Now, this scale isn't 300 million years. This is 20,000 years. So one way or another, the fossil fuel is going to go. It'll be gone in, say, 150 years. The more renewables, the more nuclear, the more hydro that we use, it won't make us stop burning the fossil fuels. We will still burn them until they're gone, unfortunately. We shouldn't be doing this. We should be using the fossil fuels as a very valuable feedstock for the petrochemical industry, for medicine, for fertilisers. But the only way to get, when we burn these fossil fuels, the only way to get rid of that carbon out of the atmosphere is by carbon capture and storage, because we are going to burn it. There is no way out of it. Even if we stopped at the current level of CO2 emissions, of fossil fuel burning at the moment, the parts per million of CO2 globally would still go up by 100 parts per million in the next 20 years. So carbon capture and storage, it's not developed. No one knows if it's going to work, but it is the only way to take the carbon out of the atmosphere. So if it works, I think we should do it. Let's have a look at the realistic contribution of some renewables. We said already that they're about half of 1% of the global energy demand. That's in equivalent terms. So anyway, you can ask me about that later if you want, but it's not terribly important. But if we increase the amount of wind globally by 50 times, if we increase the amount of hydro, if we doubled it, if our biomass went up by threefold, if our geothermal went up 70-fold, and if our marine energy went up 500-fold, you would think that we'd be in a good position. Well, in fact, there's the contribution in energy terms that all of that would achieve. It would achieve 6 terawatts of energy. Now, remember we said 80% of our energy use at the moment? That's 13 terawatts. So we're still only halfway there. So we're going to need the remainder. The remainder is solar energy, it's nuclear fission, it's possibly nuclear fusion if it's developed, and it's possibly something else, but it is necessary. So let's recap. The means to meet the challenge, we consider absolutely fully agree with the Green Party. We agree with the Green Party on so many things, it is unbelievable. It's just on the extra little, on the extra bit. Maybe not only that, but the majority of it. Improved efficiency and lower demand, absolutely. Renewables, we're going to have to ramp up with all the renewables we can get our hands on for the reasons that I've outlined earlier. We're going to need cleaner coal with carbon capture and storage, and it's a problem. Burying the coal 2 miles underground or in saline aquifers, in depleted gas fields or in used oil fields, it's not developed and it's not certain. As I said, nuclear fission and nuclear fusion. We'll need the regulation and the fiscal measures to make it happen, and we'll need parties like the Green Party to push this forward for the best global reasons. This here, looking at the solar, it shows the amount of the Earth's surface that would be needed to the amount of the Sahara that would be needed to be covered with solar panels to provide the world with their energy. It's only a small little block. To provide the EU is even smaller, and the Middle East and North Africa is even smaller. So potentially, concentrated solar or heliostats, whatever, down in the Sahara Desert is a good idea. There are problems with it, of course. that's that 15% photovoltaic I'm talking about. The cost of it is not certain. It's likely to be high. We're going to have a problem with the energy storage because obviously the sun doesn't shine at night. We're going to have a problem with transmission. For instance, if all the energy was coming up here, we're going to have, what do you say, 16 terawatts. That's 16 million megawatts. And if we're even getting 3 million megawatts of that up to, from the Sahara up to Northern Europe, that's a lot of pylons going across Spain or France or wherever, or if it's undersea. It's going to be very difficult. Concentrated solar power has difficulty in the long term with thermal fatigue. And we may be able to produce hydrogen. But it is a possibility. Let's put some effort into this and let's see what it can contribute. Absolutely. And that leaves with the nuclear, which is probably what you're here to, in a way, to listen to. I think it's important that we focus this, we put this into a global context. And I'm going to look very briefly at the items here. From the safety point of view, it may surprise you to find that I say that nuclear power is relatively safe, or it is comparatively safe. When you look at the actual facts, over 14,500 years of nuclear reactors operating, Three Mile Island had no injuries, no fatalities. Chernobyl was the worst nuclear accident, and it has contributed so far, according to the United Nations, approximately 62 deaths and 6,000 thyroid cancers, not all of which are going to lead to fatalities from cancer. Now, it was a dreadful accident. It should never have happened. And we're all working as hard as we can to make sure that kind of thing never happens again. There was no excuse for it, and I'm not making an apology for it. I just want to put it into context about the number of deaths that occur per annum, as I said earlier, 1.3 million from burning of bio-waste. In Fukushima, so far there's been no radiation-related fatalities, and none are expected. Hydroelectric power, and it's bizarre when you see this, that has the highest number of fatalities per unit of electricity produced. I'm not saying we should stop using it. No, we should use it. But we have to put these things into perspective. Coal-fired power generation, again, causes many deaths, many hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, and possibly millions, from particulate, PM10, all that stuff. So there is no silver bullet, and nothing comes without risk. From the point of view of the cost, we mentioned, I think Mark mentioned that nuclear power could be very expensive. This was a study that was issued by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, and they looked, it's based on the McKinsey model, you may have seen that, about abatement of CO2. And here is the cost of abating a tonne of CO2 in euros per tonne. And along here is the amount of CO2 that could be abated by particular technologies. And it's no surprise to say that net demand reduction, don't use the energy or use it in a more efficient way, will save Ireland up to 3 million tonnes per annum, which is quite significant. And at zero are actually negative cost. The lighting, remember I mentioned the 100-watt bulbs, getting rid of them and putting them into compact fluorescence is a great idea. But 19% of the energy use in the world at the moment is from lighting. So that's a great idea.